yesterday we were talking about the story, the narrative, and I read different stories, and they have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there are a lot of wonderful stories out there, but that doesn't make them necessarily have a plot. So what's the difference between a good story and one that has a plot?
Well, if it has a plot, it should have characterization. Mm-hmm. It should have a theme running through it. I mean, it has some kind of a...
Mm-hmm.
You said yesterday, beginning, middle, and end, of course. But, but it should be... Well...
Good question.
I don't know. It has to have... Well, you have to have a focus. You have to have something to enlist your interest, your imagination in the beginning, and then you have to have some kind of a climax, and you have to have some kind of a theme running through it.
Theme and certainly a climax. When I was this spring in Oregon, I was with a bunch of teachers and writers, and we were to evaluate children's writing samples in Oregon. And all the schools had to participate. It was third grade and 11th grade. And they all were given topics on which to write. And we had to evaluate the writing, but some of the stories turned out to be very interesting, as you can imagine. And one of the topics was to write an imaginative piece, and you're to visualize yourself living in a small town in Wyoming. And it was given an imaginary name, Laredo. And at 3 a.m., there's a light on one of the windows in a house, a lone house in Laredo, and a car speeds by at 70 miles an hour. And then you're to write a story about this. And immediately, you have to have a plot. Why would somebody have a light on at 3 a.m. in a small town? Generally, people in small towns, they're not night owls usually, and it's a farming community. And why would somebody be going 70 miles an hour at 3 a.m.? So immediately, they had to think of why this was so, and they had various different plots. I remember one was about as simple as you could possibly get. It was somebody who couldn't sleep at night, thinking about their boyfriend and a girl, and then she went down and had a midnight snack, and then a car sped by, and she wondered why it was speeding by. Then others, there were some very complicated plots, that this was, you know, some
escaping from the law or something.
Yeah, exactly. Some mass murderer out in the light, and, you know, but the main thing in this is that it's not just a story. It's why? What? Why is this going on? There's a cause behind this, and that's kind of the difference between a plot and a story. And I just got through reading this book on a book written by a contemporary writer on conflict, and he said that everything important comes in twos and with in conflict. This is the basic. He's an anthropologist by the name of Levi Strauss. So this is another aspect of a plot. Is a conflict, a basic conflict. And yet, you know, in some of the talks I've heard up here at Holden Village, you know, Christians are not to get involved in conflict and, you know, stay away. And yet, you know, this is a basic theme throughout history, is that you have, well, even the Reformation, you have Catholics, and you have somebody who came into conflict, and, you know, and so on. And but because everything important comes in twos and in conflict. And so in the plot, when you're learning about literature, they say that there are five basic conflicts: man against nature, man against society, man against himself, and Man Against Man. That's four, I guess, four different conflicts. And so that would be true in any writing. You'd pick out any book and you'd find, see.
You take Hardy or any of the, Dickens, any of the great writers.
Right, yeah. So yeah, for example, David Copperfield.
Oh, that's full of...
Man Against Society, I don't
know. Well, yeah, well, you have Against Society, David Copperfield.
Yeah, it's a real stretch for me. Yeah, I haven't read that years.
Yeah. Well, you have nature was your first one, right?
Right.
Well, you have a lot of things in nature. With the seas at the end there, where his former friend drowned, and where they had the storm, and where the nice guy the sailor who went out to rescue the guy, and they both drowned.
Mm-hmm.
That's nature, the upheaval of the great storm, the waves and all that. And then society, and David had to fight against a lot of things in society. The school he went to was very harsh. He had to escape from that,
mm-hmm.
and then he had against himself. He had conflicts himself because he was in love with the wrong girl. I didn't realize it until the end of the book. Anyway, I guess you could.
Mm-hmm.
Man Against Man.
No, that's good.
That's fighting against. He was. I don't know what the man against man would be. I guess protagonists, different people that
could be a revenge, say. Somebody had.
Uriah Heep is involved with it.
Yeah.
So that would be.
definitely Uriah Heep. Definitely.
Some of the people.
Or trying to take advantage of him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or, not behaving towards him the way he deserved. Yeah.
So you really have, in that one book, you have all these four.
Yeah.
Moments, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good, yeah. That's right. And the thing is, each book would probably be a combination.
Tale of Two Cities, whatever. Any of Dickens' books.
Mm-hmm.
He had plots within plots, and it just, of course, what. He just wrote these things for a magazine, they were printed serially, and he would write, and then he'd have to keep going, so he has all these plots within plots, but they're mm-hmm. fascinating. I love Dickens, I think he's terrific.
Oh, I do too.
They've made some great movies out of them, too. Movies.
Mm, yeah, I'm thinking about
Great
that.
Expectations. And,
Great Expectations, what a wonderful movie. That was just...
And,
that kid was so good. I forget his name.
Copperfield and Tale of Two Cities.
Uh-huh.
What else did they do? Well, there have been a number of Dickens classics that were put in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And, I went to a Dickens week, as a matter of fact, down, and they had it. They had it as one of the elder hostel programs in Southern Oregon State College in Oregon during December when the Shakespeare Festival was over.
Mm-hmm.
The Shakespeare Festival is just in the summer and the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So after end of September, first part of October was over. But they had an elder hostel in December where they had Christmas customs of different lands, and they had a Jewish rabbi who came in and talked about some of the Jewish customs of the Seder and the Passover and so forth. Then they had this whole business with Dickens, and showed a couple of the films during that week.
Mm-hmm.
And Ashland was all decorated for the Christmas season.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what they did down there.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Outside of the Shakespeare Festival.
Just
period.
Wonderful. Yeah.
So they have all their out of the year. It just goes on and on and on all year, and they have three or four of them usually going on at the same time during the summer season. They have more elder hostels there than anywhere else in the country.
Is that right?
It's the biggest elder hostel program in the country.
Yeah.
And I think it was the salvation of the college because they do make money on these elder hostels. They bust them in. I mean, the people that's come in, and they have three or four going on at the same time.
Oh.
But anyway, they had that one December, and I do like Dickens, so that was interesting.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, he's a wordy guy, and it takes a while to get through his books. Yeah. That's the thing. Why it's sort of unusual to talk to somebody who's read so much of him.
Yeah, he's great.
Now there was a guy. Those are the basic four plots. I mean, the conflicts.
Nature, society, man, and then self.
Man against himself.
The four.
Okay, then there was a guy by the name of George Pulte, who decided there were, in totality, 36 dramatic situations that, of all of history, that you could get yourself into. And he asked people to prove him wrong. Are there more? Are there less? 36 different dramatic situations. And his name was George Polti.
George Peel?
Pulte, or something. Sounds Pulte. Italian, Pulte.
Well, how do you spell it?
Polti.
Yeah.
Pulte. And, for example, here...
Well, this is a book that he's written, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's he called? What's the name of the book?
Well, that's the title, 36
dramatic situations.
Yeah. Probably have a bibliography on it somewhere.
Pulte,
36 plots.
P-O-L-T-I.
Yeah, that's the name. It was written in 1986. So it's possible people have come up with more since then. But anyway, here are some of them. Okay, plot number one, dealing with a threat. Okay, plot number two, taking vengeance or being pursued in vengeance. And plot number three, overcoming an obstacle or not overcoming an obstacle. Another one, solving or not solving a problem. Another one, being in a position of rivalry with a relative. And so on. And I have the sort of a list of about 14 of them here. But you could probably get this in the library. It's looks like it was published by The Writer Incorporated. But the funny thing about these plots is I was reading through these.
Not Writer's Digest. Writer's
It was published by The Writer Incorporated in Boston.
Never heard of them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of books put out by Writer's Digest, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Writer's Incorporated, okay.
The funny thing about these plots is I was... I watch a soap opera pretty regularly.
Yeah.
And... I'm embarrassed to say, but I enjoy it.
Well, they follow pretty much along the line of romance novels, don't they?
Yeah.
And they're very popular.
But the funny thing is, as I was reading this list, I realized that each and every one of these plots had been on the soap opera.
Oh. Uh-huh.
Each and every one of them. And it was pretty obvious, you know, that they were the...
romance novels like that. I mean, you have a heroine.
Mm-hmm.
And she has an experience usually in a castle or a dark forbidding house.
Yeah.
Sinister people in it, like a mentally disturbed person who hides in an upper room or something. and a man who seems very pleasant, genial, but he's really not. He's really sort of nasty, and then she gets ensnared with this guy, and then she's saved by some nice guy. I mean, there's a regular. It's always a girl that's in, you know, that gets into a tricky situation, and she has to be extricated from that physician, uh-huh. and she's saved in the end. And yeah, there's a certain pattern to those Rumi's novels, which uh-huh. makes them so popular, with, especially yeah. with women. And yeah. women, all the names, all the authors of romance novels mm-hmm. are women.
Yeah.
Ostensibly. I mean, yeah. the names are women. Now, some of them are written by men, but mm-hmm. they can't put a man's name on it. It has to be a woman's name. So a man has to have a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. uh-huh. Because the women will not read it. It's written by a man because they figure he doesn't know what he's talking about. Doesn't know feminine psychology, etc. So, what men do write them, they can't put their own
name on.
That's
funny.
Yeah. Did you know that?
Yeah. No, I didn't know that.
They have to.
I've heard.
They're all. You always have a woman's name on this, but they're not all written by women. But
well, I didn't know that.
But
Barbara Cortland.
Well, yeah. Well, there are. Yeah. yeah. Most of them are women, but the few men who do write have to put a girl, a woman's name. They have to have a nom de plume or something.
Nom de plume, yeah. That's the
yeah, way. That's the way, anyway.
But yeah. anyway, I think that this is could be valuable in writing a family history.
Yeah.
If you can possibly see a use for one of these plots in your family mm-hmm. history. Mm-hmm. When I read over this, I thought, you know, there's always something going on in a family, whether it's a father and a son, and the son is trying to go off in a new direction, and the father doesn't want it, or something, and or like you said, a marriage that just didn't work out, and so I think this is kind of helpful because at least it gets you to simplify the theme, and I think in writing you've got to keep a simple theme that people can follow.
Yeah.
If you go off in too many different directions, they can't follow that main thread. And so I thought that these plots would be real helpful there. Mm-hmm. So those are the plot ideas. This is writing the family narrative, and it's the author was Lawrence Goldrup, and I got this at Oregon Historical Society.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a local. It doesn't really say where he's from or anything, but I think it's a local.
What is it? Writing the Family History.
Writing the Family Narrative. So, and I thought it was really one of the better books on this.
And what's his name?
And his name is Goldrup, G-O-U-L-D-R-U-P, Ph.D. And so, like I said, the Oregon Historical Society is where I got it. So, well, that's about all I have to say on plot. And then I thought I'd kind of move into a sense of place, because every family history must be located in place or places. And so, the first thing I decided was how to describe a place, how do you talk or write about a place, and first thing is the physical description, the geology, the fauna, in geology, the geomorphology, is it mountainous, is it lake country, is it a desert, is it a plains, Midwestern farm country, etc. What is its basic physical description outside of what people have done? And I picked up this book by Willa Cather, and she thought had a great description of Nebraska, which kind of sticks in my mind, having traveled over across the country. She, in the book, she says when she was 10 years old, she moved from Virginia to Nebraska. And she went by a carriage, and she was 10 years old. And she writes, "I do not remember crossing the Missouri River or anything about the long day's journey through Nebraska. Probably by the time I crossed so many rivers, I was dull to them. The only thing very noticeable about Nebraska was that it was still, all day long, Nebraska." It's sort of, I just thought of
it's
like...
It's pretty flat country, too.
North Dakota.
The southern part of Nebraska, anyway. Is, I mean, along Route 80, it's pretty flat. Long distances. Yeah.
And then about the Pacific Northwest, there's probably been a lot written about it. I just found this book by Emily Carr. Have you heard of her? She's lived in Victoria, British Columbia. And she's an artist, but a writer as well. And she writes about the Pacific Northwest. She says, "The silence of our western forest was so profound that our ears could scarcely comprehend it. If you spoke, your voice came back to you as your face is thrown back to you in a mirror. It seemed as if the forest were so full of silence that there was no room for sounds. The birds who lived there were the birds of prey, eagles, hawks, owls. Had a songbird loosed his throat, the others would have pounced. Sober-colored, silent little birds were the first to follow the settlers west. Gulls had always been. They began with the sea and had always cried over it. The vast sky spaces above, hungry for noise, steadily lapped up their cries. But the forest was different. She brooded over silence and secrecy." And I think she's talking about the early old growth forest here. And that's kind of gone. But it must be, you know, what it must have been like, a silent.
Yeah, except that the Olympic National Forest is quite a bit of, it hasn't been cut over.
Mm-hmm.
Puget Sound area, Olympic National Forest, the old growth forest, the whole rainforest, that area.
Yeah, I haven't been to that, but I think it would be wonderful.
It's great up there, but you know, that's pretty unspoiled.
Mm-hmm.
One of the few places it is.
But that's a physical description where she talks about the silence, and the other one she talks about the flat, long, nothing. And then going back to Willard Cather, she talks about how space or the place affected her. She says, "I tried to sleep, but the jolting made me bite my tongue, and I soon began to ache all over. When the straw settled down, I had a hard bed. Cautiously, I slipped from under my buffalo hide, got up on my knees, and peered over the side of the wagon. There seemed to be nothing to see, no fences, no creeks, or hills, or trees, or hills, or fields. If there was a road, I could not make it out in the faint starlight. There was nothing but land, not a country at all, but the material out of which countries are made. No, there was nothing but land, slightly undulating, I knew, because often our wheels ground against the brake as we went down into a hollow and lurched up again on the other side. I had the feeling that the world was left behind, and we had got over the edge of it and were outside man's jurisdiction. I had never looked up at the sky when there was not a familiar mountain ridge against it. But this was the complete dome of heaven, all there was of it. I did not believe that my dead father and mother were watching me from up there. They would still be looking at me at the sheepfold down by the creek or along the white road that led to the mountain pastures. I had left even their spirits behind me. The wagon jolted on, carrying me, I knew not whither. I don't think I was homesick. If we never arrived anywhere, it did not matter. Between that earth and that sky, I felt erased, blotted out. I did not say my prayers that night. Here I felt what would be." So that's
that. Is this an autobiography?
I think, yeah, it's somewhat. It's considered a novel, but she went through a similar experience, you know. She had grown up in this hilly country and then moved to the flat. And you hear this in other immigrant novels like Giants in the Earth, how when they got there and it was so flat, they just felt erased. They just felt like they didn't, it didn't seem like human scale.
Biographical novel, yeah.
Yeah. But she's talking about this physical, but she's also relating it to how almost a spiritual sense. She says she doesn't feel like her dead father and mother could be even here. It's so impersonal in a way. It's just so flat, and she doesn't feel her identity because of the vastness of it. And you know, this is just Willa Cather's opinion, but you know, a lot of those immigrants said the same thing.
And she hasn't been dead that many years either. I don't
know.
No. So that, you know, she was a little girl. And she was, I don't know how old she was when she died. That's bringing it right up into modern times. I mean, around 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, they were still traveling over land. A lot of them, of course, the railroad was in, but and some of them were still coming by a covered wagon in the 1880s, 1890s.
Yeah, and she said there is no country here.
Yeah.
So the feeling was it was just land.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. You know, every description of every place we think of, we always think of it in connection with people.
Yeah.
But what if it was just land and there was no history?
Yeah.
And of course there was a history, but she didn't know it. It was the Indian history.
Yeah.
And probably she didn't feel any connection to that. So,
well, this would be very similar to people coming into wilderness areas, like crossing Pennsylvania and going into new areas around the time of the Revolution. That would be what my family history would start with, coming over the Susquehanna River or crossing New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And around that time, these new communities were being formed on the edge of the wilderness, which was central Pennsylvania at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they had established a fort over what is now Pittsburgh, but
mm-hmm.
a lot of that
area
had not been developed, so they were coming in there. I could work that in somehow or other, I guess. Coming in, and just very few settlers, still occasionally having problems with the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And coming into the communities and raiding them on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the, between the 1790s and the early 1800s, establishing communities all through that central Pennsylvania area.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually hacking out more communities by chopping down the trees and pushing further westward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, everything that happened here probably happened there just earlier in time.
Yeah.
But the geography was a little bit more, probably what they were used to, I would just guess.
Yeah.
In Pennsylvania seems hilly and trees and...
It's very much like the area of New Jersey when they came.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's sort of the psychological space. Now, this guy, what's his name?
Physical description, and that was what...
Okay, so physical description of just the geology.
And then the psychological.
And then there's the psychological and then spiritual. And I kind of related them because I think her feeling that she was very alone there affected her. She said, I can't pray tonight because it just seems like nature is taken over here. She said, what will be. So the fact that there had never been any people there kind of caused her to have a spiritual blackout, so to speak. And I feel that was a problem with a lot of the immigrants, and I've been told that for some of them, it was not just the land, but also losing their native language. That also caused them to feel cut off from their spiritual roots.
Yeah.
But anyway, since I'm talking about...
How do you differentiate there between the psychological and the spiritual?
Well, I guess I'd have to say they're very related. And probably in this country, in our century, they're not, we don't relate them that much, because we think of psychology as something, you know, to see if you can adapt better or, you know, solve some of your problems, your neuroses and that. And we think of spiritual as something you go to church and, you know, pray. And not too many psychologists are going to say, let's sit down and pray. You know, it's, there's sort of a gap there. But I think actually they're very connected. And when for her, they were certainly connected. She said she felt this aloneness, and then she felt like she couldn't pray that night. So